hi there, and thanks for checking out That's So Money for this edition. We're recording this on December the 11th, and we come to you from the palatial office at home at my house. At home at my house. Okay, that works. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jeff Munn. I got a lot of things. I'm just going to go hopscotch around a number of topics this week, and so I'm not going to waste a lot of time. Let's get right to things that are at the top of a lot of people's minds. I'm going to spend just a moment talking about the ASU-Stanford game in this respect. I agree with those people who say if you had told Sun Devil Nation in August that they would win 10 games and go to the Holiday Bowl, it would be a great season. It has been a great season, there's no question, and I agree with Todd Graham's final words when he left the podium on Saturday night that we're just getting started. Why did they lose the game? Basically comes down to the size of the offensive and defensive lines for Stanford. Much bigger, very physical. And ASU in time will put together a defensive and offensive line that rivals Stanford in terms of size. It was the same thing that they ran into against Notre Dame. Their three losses this year have been to teams that greatly outsized them up front. That'll change in recruiting as Todd Graham really starts to plug in his four-year players. He's done a tremendous job, by the way, with junior college transfers, which traditionally aren't supposed to be that effective on a Division I, a BCS-level program. But they have been in this case, and now Todd Graham has a chance to really pump the type of talent he wants into this program through players that he recruits out of high school. All right, now on to other matters. Oh, one other thing about ASU. I don't worry about their focus for the Holiday Bowl against Texas Tech. There are a lot of situations where a team would be flat after a disappointing loss and some time to just kind of sit around and reflect or stew on it, as it were. I don't worry about that with ASU. I think their focus will be right where it should be the night of December 30th. The BCS. I know a lot of people are thrilled with the idea this is the final year of the BCS. And I should preface anything I say by telling you that for the past 21 years, I've been very honored, and I'll do it for the 22nd time this year, to be the stadium announcer for the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl and for the last, oh gosh, I don't remember how many years, the Buffalo Wild Wings Bowl. I love bowl games. I love the atmosphere. I love the traditions. I love everything about college football bowl games. You should know that up front. And I've not been too terribly disappointed with what the BCS has done the last several years, especially since they've gone to the plus one game, the championship game. No system is perfect. Even pro football playoffs or pro basketball playoffs or the Major League Baseball playoffs have their flaws. Sometimes teams get in and teams with better records don't in given years. So no system is 100% perfect. There's only one perfect playoff system. And it's a phrase that I've used a lot of times in relation to the BCS. The BCS, or putting together the championship game of the BCS, is like putting together the guest list for a wedding. You can't please everybody unless you invite everybody. The only perfect playoff system is to have everybody play in it. Well, that's silly. You're not going to do that. For a variety of reasons in college football, there are too many schools. It would take too long. And if you really are concerned about devaluing the regular season, that would do it. I know a lot of people are very excited about the playoff that will occur starting next year. But let's employ that system this year. The first two teams in, that's fairly easy, Florida State and Auburn. Then it starts getting a little bit dicey when you get to 3 and 4. Pretty good argument for Michigan State. Really good argument for Alabama. Really good argument for Ohio State. Oh, wait a minute. That's three schools for two spots. You see, you never completely clean up the controversy. Think about the NCAA basketball tournament. They now take 68 teams in the men's tournament. Team 69 always stands up and says, "We got robbed." There have been a few years here at Arizona State where they were on the bubble, didn't make it, and felt like they didn't get treated fairly. The difference is with the basketball tournament, you're talking about Team 68 or 69, you're not generally not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about it nationally that a team that finished in the middle of a pack in its conference deserved a chance to play for the national championship. And there are very few examples. Villanova is the one that jumps immediately to mind of a team that barely got in at the last second and goes on and wins the national championship. There may be others that I can't think of right off the top, but Villanova is the one I always think of. So this four-team playoff, and look, I'm all for finding a way to incorporate teams into a playoff to determine a national champion. But if you think that this is going to solve all the problems, you are wrong. And I guess the only way for me to prove this is to revisit this 1 year from now. If we had this scenario this year with a four-team playoff, somebody pretty good's getting left out. Probably Ohio State. How about Oregon? Yeah, I know they have two losses, but Oregon would be up there screaming and yelling that they should be in. Stanford, off their performance against ASU in the Pac-12 championship game, would probably have a decent argument saying, hey, we should be considered for the playoff. We won our last game. Alabama didn't. So you see, it doesn't solve all the problems. But I just going back to what I was talking about earlier, there are people who are also wondering, how well is Baylor and Central Florida going to do at the gate? How well is it going to do on television? I can't predict what the television numbers are going to be, but I know this. Every year that I've been involved with the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl, the scene, the atmosphere, the game has been terrific. Some of the games have been blowouts, there's no question. But the pageantry is the thing that always gets me. And keep in mind also that some of the best Fiesta Bowls in history have been games that going in, you didn't expect it to be that way. Remember 2007 when Oklahoma and Boise State met in the Fiesta Bowl? A week after that, Ohio State and Florida met in the first ever BCS championship game. But very few people remember that game because it was a one-sided Florida blowout. Oklahoma and Boise State, of course, staged what many considered to be the greatest college football game ever played, at least until this year's Iron Bowl. So you see, you can't judge it going in and say, well, this isn't going to be much. I always remember a couple of years ago when Oklahoma played Connecticut at the Fiesta Bowl. Now, Connecticut is not a football power, but the atmosphere in that building that night was electric because UConn had never been to a BCS game before. In spite of horrible weather back east, they traveled a pretty fair amount of fans, and everybody had a great time. A lot of people are saying, well, how many fans are Central Florida going to travel? I think they're going to surprise you with how many people they bring out for that game. Same thing with Baylor. The teams in Texas have a huge following. It isn't all just Texas. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Lubbock for a basketball game, and it was a Saturday night that Texas Tech played Baylor at the Cowboy Stadium in Arlington. And I went into a little bar and grill across the street from campus to get some dinner. Place was packed. And you would have thought Texas Tech was like number one in the country, the way fans were trash-talking and beating their chest, especially when Texas Tech got out to a 14-0 lead. So you see, all those schools in Texas have rabid followings. And I do think Baylor will bring out a sizable amount of fans. They've never been in a BCS game before. So this is going to be a huge event for the school, for Art Briles, and the entire program. And if you have a chance to get tickets, you really should, because, as I said, the pageantry is tremendous. Some other things in the notebook. Last Friday, I was in Chicago to fill in on the ASU men's basketball game at DePaul. If you remember the game prior against Miami of Florida, I should say, Jahi Carson injured his ankle, and there was a huge question mark about Jahi going right up to game time in Chicago. Well, he played. He played 37 minutes. He scored 23 points. He grabbed 9 rebounds and dished out 5 assists. There was a reason that no fewer than 10 NBA teams had scouts on the floor, and probably more teams had scouts in the stands to watch Jahi Carson. There are a couple of really outstanding players for DePaul as well, but most of those guys were there to see Jahi Carson. He is, in no uncertain terms, the straw that stirs the drink for Herb Sendek's Sun Devils. Jordan Baczynski has had a fabulous start to his year. But when Carson goes down, that team becomes dramatically different. And as long as Carson stays healthy, number one, I do believe they are easily an NCAA tournament team. And I am still scratching my head how the coaches in the Pac-12 could have picked ASU as low as they did in their preseason poll. If you look around the league, I don't see, outside of obviously Arizona, I don't see a team that is so dramatically better than Arizona State that you would automatically say, well, ASU can't compete with those guys. UCLA's got the potential to be very strong, but After Arizona, I still think, and I'm more convinced than ever, that the fight for the second, third, and fourth spots, which bring with them a first-round bye in the conference tournament, is very much going to be up for grabs. I was very, very impressed with the way ASU played. They came off a really disheartening loss to Miami of Florida and Anaheim. And while DePaul isn't quite the glamour program it once was a long time ago, they still have some talent on that roster. That's the other thing, and I just point this out. The game was played at the Rosemont Horizon, which has been renamed the Allstate Arena. There couldn't have been more than 1,000 people in that building. At one time, 30 years ago, DePaul basketball under Ray Meyer, and Ray Meyer had been there a lot longer than just the 1970s and 80s, but with players like Mark McGuire and Terry Cummings, DePaul basketball really burst onto the national scene and obviously the local sporting scene in Chicago. But it's downright sad to see what it's become in the last several years. Oliver Purnell, their head coach, is a tremendous coach, and given time, he will build that program back up. They are building a new arena for, among other things, DePaul basketball, a lot closer to campus, and that'll help the situation as well. The D-backs trade, and I know a lot of you are wondering about that. I will tell you this. I love the trade from this standpoint. They did need power to protect Paul Goldschmidt. Yes, Mark Trumbo strikes out a lot. He's a bit of a liability defensively. But this team needs to add protection for Goldschmidt. And I really don't think that it came at that high a price. Adam Eaton has some liabilities in terms of his overall play. Sometimes he plays out of control and does things that just he shouldn't do, and it's over-exuberance, but he has not learned to bring it under control. As for Tyler Skaggs, there has been a drop in velocity. That's not to mean that he can't still be an effective major league pitcher. It just means that he's not the pitcher that he was once thought to be when the D-backs acquired him in the Dan Heron deal, sending Heron to the Angels back in 2010. That, and you get a couple prospects from both the White Sox and Angels organizations. I don't see where the criticism is on this one. Let me tell you one other thing real quick as we close out this week's edition. I know that there's a lot of talk about the status of Kevin Towers and Kirk Gibson, who are in the final year of their contracts. Their options were not picked up, and it was essentially the front office saying, look, you need to prove yourselves over again. I think it's very hard in Major League Baseball to cycle through general managers every three or four year basis. And the best example of it is the Pittsburgh Pirates. Several years ago, they committed to Neil Huntington. They pulled him out of the Cleveland front office to be their general manager. And finally, the Pirates were patient and just said, we're going to let Huntington build this up. Have they been through a couple of managers? Yeah. Lloyd McClendon was there when Huntington got on board. They went to John Russell, and then they went to Clint Hurdle. All the while, Huntington was stockpiling draft picks. He drafted a number of talented players. Pedro Alvarez finally coming into his own. But there's a number of players on the big league roster and in the farm system that were put in place by Neil Huntington. And they were allowed to stay there and develop as Pirates. They weren't part of some panic move to get a veteran player who was at the tail end of his career for four or five prospects. There wasn't a move to try to cut down on payroll by getting rid of players who would be eligible for arbitration in a couple of years. You have to stick with the plan. Kevin Towers has been the GM in Arizona now for 3 years plus. And a lot of the players that he has dealt away out of the farm system the last couple of years have been players that were drafted by the previous regime. Tyler Skaggs was acquired by Jerry DePoto before Kevin Towers got on board. And that's not to say that DePoto made a mistake. But general managers have a philosophy. They have an idea of how they want to build an organization. And the truth be told, there may still be some players from the Josh Burns era in the Arizona farm system that don't quite fit the profile of the type of player Kevin Towers likes to build a farm system with. So it's going to take time. Unfortunately, you can cycle through managers a little more quickly, and I'm not making a comment on the status of Kirk Gibson, but I think you have to be very careful when you start tossing around the idea of changing general managers. You really are starting all over again when you do that. And if you don't stop doing it, you get on a treadmill that you never seem to get off of. Just ask Pittsburgh. That's this week's edition of That's So Money. I'll be back next week with a few more thoughts about things going on in sports. As always, you can check out the latest in sports right here at sportsaz360.com. Thanks for joining us. I'll talk to you next week.